England?
I'm not even sure what the question was there.
The question was, you were listing the materials that are ferromagnetic, at least I understood it this way. But at the same time, ferrimagnetic are supposed to be stronger, are being used, let's say, in isolators and circulators. So my question was, what's so special in the ferrite materials, magnetic materials, containing gases, I would say, that they all attract a certain length of the waves, electromagnetic waves. Back to you.
Oh, okay, I understand now. What happens is we were talking about DC and inductance before. Oxides have another property that will help you. Understand that, first, that when you're talking about irons and nickels with respect to frequency, tend to be very, very lossy. So if you're making like an EMI filter or something like that, having EMI filter components that have, where you need high inductance and you want to absorb and be lossy at high frequencies, you want to use the heavy metals, you know, your iron, nickel, cobalt, that kind of stuff. It's going to be very lossy at high frequency. If you want to create magnetic fields at higher frequency, oxides can be more beneficial because now that you have a higher frequency component on it, with the oxide, will have lower losses at higher frequency AC. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to try a question with you, Glenn. Maybe you've got an answer to it. And this is still a bit of a mystery to me. In the case of a circulator, a Y-junction circulator, where you've got a chunk of magnetic material above and below the strip line, and all of this is housed inside of a triplate strip line structure, and an external magnetic field is biasing your ferrite-like materials. I'm reasonably sure that the biased magnetic materials, in the presence of the microwave signal propagating down them, are experiencing a kind of magnetic precession, somewhat like what takes place inside of a Yeager filter. So let's assume now that my material is in close proximity to the center's Y-shaped structure of the circulator. Explain that between ports 1, 2, and 3, you have a clockwise propagating signal, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 1. You also have a counterclockwise propagating signal, 1 to 3, 3 to 2, 2 to 1. So you've got a clockwise and a counterclockwise signal, and you have a precessing magnetic material. If my magnetic material is precessing in a clockwise manner, is that what's creating a different rate of propagation for the clockwise signal versus the counterclockwise microwave signal? It's not quite clear to me why. Is it co- or counterclockwise matching that makes the signal propagate more slowly or more rapidly? I wonder if that makes some sense, and I wonder if you've got an opinion as to how that takes place. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Glenn, I still didn't get why microwaves are so much attracted to that.
Wesley, your question first, because that basically was just that the ferrimagnetic materials are going to be lower lossy. Okay, in other words, there's going to be less loss at the higher frequencies than ferromagnetics. So those materials are chosen because of the heat losses. In other words, otherwise the other materials would be, you'd be dissipating too much heat and your losses would be too high. Dick, as far as the circulator goes, I'm not really sure I've got the right answer for you on this one, but I think it mainly is time domain. From where the signal is coming is relationship back to the original port. But I'm not sure I'm really answering your question properly here, and I'd probably have to draw the pictures out and understand it properly, and probably if the two of us put our head together with a diagram, we could probably get it correct. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do it for you here, talking over the air like this. T2 IWPV2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm curious as to whether or not the faster signal is going in the same direction as the precession. I'm going to guess that's true. But if somebody told me that the faster signal goes in the opposite direction from the precession, then I'm going to be asking why. The velocities of propagation at the molecular level or at the atomic level are kind of mysterious, really mysterious at first, to find out that all the air molecules in the room with you are moving a little bit less than 1.5 times the speed of sound. So 3 air molecules in the room with you right now are moving 500 meters per second, when the speed of sound is 300 and some odd meters per second. Boy, that is fast. And every one of those molecules of air are encountering each other, but every one of those encounters is a perfect bounce where they never really touch. They never really touch the wall. That's why there's no energy loss, per se, of all of those encounters. And they're encountering each other at something like a 8 billion times per second rate, simply because each individual air molecule moving 500 meters per second in average speed has a mean free path of 63 nanoseconds. You do the mathematics of that, and it comes out to one encounter every 8 billion encounters per second. Boy, they're busy. Wow. And even though the average spacing between the air molecules in the room is 3 nanometers, and they're a tenth of a nanometer in diameter, so there's a lot of space around them as far as diameter to spacing is concerned. And it's because of that very small diameter to spacing that on average one can move 63 nanometers.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's a very large spacing to diameter ratio, which is what? A 30-to-1 ratio that allows them to move 63 nanometers. That's quite a long distance, so to speak. 63 nanometers is what? 20 some odd times the diameter of 20 times the spacing. So the rate of them hitting each other, so to speak, and I put that in quotes, is fairly small. Well, it's a reasonably long mean free path. And now you try to figure out what happens when a flame front occurs, when you're getting combustion. What's happening at the atomic level or the molecular level? Ain't easy. I mean, you and I can put hydrogen and oxygen inside of a test tube and they just sit there and ignore each other. And all those hydrogen and oxygen molecules are bouncing each other, off each other at the rates that I'm talking about. But when one of them does something a little bit unusual, when one or two of those
kaboom,
you got it. When one or two of those hydrogen molecules climbs over the hill energy-wise and latches onto that oxygen molecule, jumps down to a lower energy state, and emits some number of photons, at least a photon, and maybe some number of photons. Somehow that photon coming from that one molecule that did this joining up process hits another inert hydrogen-oxygen combination nearby, and somehow that sets them off, and pretty soon you've got one hell of a chain reaction. And would you be able to give the explanation for knocking? I mean, some people say the knocking means you're really getting an explosion in there as opposed to a particular velocity front, a velocity of the flame front. What's the real difference between high and low velocity of flame front versus a knocking explosion? Got a clarity on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2REW.
I assume you're talking about automotive technology in a combustion chamber where you have a flame front and you have a quick change in pressure where the amount of exchange of energy due to that ignition of fuel will basically start expanding the gas at a fixed rate that starts pushing the piston down, as opposed to a pre-ignition, which where the timing of the gas where it's accumulated in one corner of the cylinder is basically releasing its energy in a small part in a very, very short period of time before the piston is actually in the correct spot. So there's a lot of things going on there, at least if you are speaking about the automotive technology in an engine.
Yeah, I'm almost of the opinion that it's easier to explain the operation of a diesel engine as opposed to a non-diesel engine. When I'm compressing a gas, when you and I have probably already discussed what happens as to the bottom of our bicycle pump. Why does the bottom of the bicycle pump get hot? My explanation is the so-called ping-pong paddle effect, that you've got a moving wall, and the rate of moving of the wall gets doubled, and that gets coupled into the air molecule, and now it's moving faster, and a faster-moving air molecule, we call it higher temperature. So in the very high compression ratio you get in a diesel engine, by the movement of the piston, ping-pong paddle effect, you're now making the materials in that piston have a much higher speed, velocity, kinetic energy, temperature, and eventually the temperature is so high, the speed is so high, that now the hydrogens and oxygens, if it was that mixture, are capable of joining. And once one of them joins, again, you're getting this photon emission, which triggers the rest of them. So the increase in velocity, which really is the increase in temperature, that's due to the compression in a diesel engine, seems to make it a little bit more understandable as to how the mixture ignites. Over to you, Glenn, KQLIW.
Yeah, what's interesting about the gasoline engine is that the valve timing and the ignition timing are tied in such a way that you're actually controlling the pressures. One of the interesting things about ignition timing is that you have to allow the intake valve, depending on the RPM, to open up at a certain point to bring the fuel in on the downstroke of the piston. But then you have the compression stroke, and while another cylinder nearby in a multi-piston engine is actually in an exhaust stroke. So what you really want to do is actually fire that ignition system just at a point to where you start, where you're actually, you're before top and center. In other words, the piston is actually, you know, just about on the way up. So in other words, the fuel isn't completely compressed. And at that point in time, you'll start the burn or the with a larger volume in the cylinder. So as the compression is coming up, it's actually, you've already started the ignition so that it has a slower rate, where if you wait too late in the combustion cycle, basically what happens is the too much heat goes out the exhaust. You start too early, the flame takes place as the piston is coming up too soon and tries to push the piston back down again. So it's all timing related. You got everything happening just at the right time and place. K4IW, KQQIQ.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I want to point out that the difference in timing in the gasoline engine is based on the velocity of combustion. Gasoline burns slowly compared to hydrogen and oxygen. As you know, I've experimented a lot with that kind of stuff. The actual timing of the engine, you ignite the gasoline even before top dead center. It takes a while to burn. The rate, the velocity of burning in the case of hydrogen oxygen is much faster. If you do a mixed fuel thing like I do with a number of cars, you actually have to move the timing closer to top dead center closer to increase velocity and the properties of burning. And by the way, hydrogen and oxygen, if you put them in a test tube, they have a propensity to combine with each other and create water without giving off photons. K2IWKJ.
Yeah, let's try that again. By the way, if I ran my engine on hydrogen, I've got to use much later timing because of the faster flame front. You're telling me if I put a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen in a test tube in a 2-to-1 ratio, I guess that's counting molecules, that's not necessarily volume or weight, but they're counting molecules, I got twice as many molecules of hydrogen versus oxygen. If I just let it sit there, you're telling me beads of water will form at the bottom? And no flame front? I'm amazed by that. Over to you, Eric.
Now you don't have to be amazed by it. Just consider that it actually happened. Also, if you had to have combustion for it to create water, fuel cells would work.
Okay. if my test tube has just the right stoichiometric mixture, and maybe I set it in the sun, maybe I don't, how long must I wait for it to all go into water? And do I end up with a vacuum in that closed off test tube? Over to you, Eric.
No, there's a what is it called? It starts with an I. It has to do with pressure. A certain amount of that hydrogen oxide for a given volume will create water, and it'll be in the form of water vapor. And if you have large enough bottles, then you would actually see water on the bottom of your test tube. But yeah, when you dissociate, one of the problems with that. Many of the companies have with dissociation of water, even with using fuel cells in reverse, is a propensity to recombine with itself. It has to do with hydrogen ion and oxygen ion, is the opposite of one, where their natural state is they want to grab onto each other.
Okay, as the hydrogen and oxygen start slowly combining in my test tube and creating water molecules at the bottom, I'm removing the gaseous material, turning it into a liquid material, leaving back a, leaving left over a partial vacuum. And the water in the liquid state at the bottom at room temperature has a certain vapor pressure, and therefore you will eventually reach equilibrium, and you've got a partial vacuum in there. If I had a continuous supply of hydrogen and oxygen available through a tiny little tube going into this test tube, so that the gaseous pressure in there remained atmospheric pressure, and the temperature remained room temperature. So I've got a continuous supply of oxygen and hydrogen available, and by some magic I make sure that the ones that are not being pumped in, but they're available, are at the right ratio of hydrogen to oxygen. In that thoroughly passive experiment where I never ignite the mixture in the test tube, and I've got new reactive materials always available, if I wait long enough, does that test tube completely fill up with water? Over to you, Eric.
You know, I can't say that that test tube will completely fill up with water, because there is a certain amount of static gas to liquid ratio. But if I introduce a catalyst like platinum, then yes, I can actually make complete conversion between hydrogen and oxygen and water. But there is a static equilibrium between the vapor pressure and the actual pressure in the volume of the vessel that you have as you use them. But you're trying to say if you constantly feed oxygen and hydrogen, then you're changing the static gaseous pressure within that vessel. But if you have a fixed volume of hydrogen and oxygen, there becomes a balance and equilibrium that it becomes a static vapor pressure and gas pressure.
Is the explanation for the water forming in the bottom of that test tube the fact that you've got a random distribution of speeds of the individual molecules, and there's a very small but statistically significant probability that after a zillion bounces, one of those hydrogens or one of those oxygens builds up a real high speed, goes ramming into the hydrogen rams into the oxygen and vice versa, and therefore there's enough kinetic energy to create the reaction. But it's only one molecule at a time. And that one molecule doing it obviously is now going to a lower energy state, giving off a photon. And by some magic, that photon given off doesn't create a chain reaction. If I create a spark somewhere, the flame front I thought was propagating by way of photons being given off, here is a natural reaction of photons given off, and it doesn't trigger a chain reaction. So I see a little bit of a paradox there. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2QIQ, the comment?
No, I understand what you're saying, Dick. And it is something that occurs naturally. It don't have the mechanical explanation to give you, maybe Glenn does. But it is a, you know, a known property. Also, what is it, hydrogen has to occur as a diatomic, has to exist diatomically, as opposed to really can't have a single atom of hydrogen. And there's some other mechanics that go on in there, and you know what? I could actually look it up and give you the precise mechanical explanation of, or at least the theory of what's going on. There's a similar case when you use platinum or rhodium or some other form of catalyst. And in those cases, you know, you could take hydrogen and oxygen, put it in a bottle, and actually put some electrodes in there, and you actually got a gas battery, which is something that I don't know what it's called. I'm trying to remember who it was. In the 1800s, they did experiments like that. There is a battery. You can actually take a simple two similar metals if you want, and say like a simple catalyst like potassium hydroxide or sodium bicarbonate, saturate that in water, and put two electrodes in there, and you've got yourself a gas battery.
You brought up an interesting point. The hydrogen is really H2, the oxygen is really O2, and so therefore, four of the hydrogen molecules and two of the oxygen molecules all have to decide that, hey, we're going to get together. We're just the right combination. So just one H2 and one O2 really is not going to do it. Maybe Glenn can clear this all up. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I think it's easy to see that when you use platinum or an outside catalyst, how you can basically rearrange the structure of the molecules to create the water. Because it's basically the free electrons at that point, then you can create the bond. But I think also, if you just take hydrogen and oxygen, I don't believe you do get water unless you have nitrogen. So in other words, if you've got nitrogen in the mix, then you actually have the extra electron count there to create the bond that you need to create the water. So I think in air, when you're mixing, you know, say hydrogen and oxygen, you know, you need the nitrogen or some other, you know, substrate in between to complete that in order to get the water out there. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
On many of these explosive mixtures, there's a reasonably narrow range of the reactants required in order to get the flame front or explosion. In the case of natural gas, there's a rather narrow range of natural gas. Too much natural gas or too little, you won't get a bang. We all think that if we get a gas leak in the house, we're going to get an explosion. But it requires just the right mixture and just the right ratios. And I'm not quite sure how the catalyst does it, but I guess we ought to get back to electronics, and that is, I'm going to give a quick explanation for why we use impedance measuring devices.
Dick, I just have, before that, I have a question to all three gentlemen of you. We have a five linear element. One of them is resistor, the other one is capacitor, the third one is inductor, and the fourth one is ideal transformer. What is the fifth one?
Yeah, there's been a couple of articles recently in some of the scientific journals about the fifth element that has been discovered, which is a time-varying resistor.
The sixth one. The fifth one, maybe Glenn and Eric. The fifth one is not that one.
Okay, do Glenn and Eric know what the fifth element is?
I'm not aware.
Not sure, Dick.
You're going to have to tell us, Wes.
Okay, and to exceed. Gyrator. G-Y-R-A-T-O-R, Gyrator. This one is the two-port electrical network element and was invented by Telegen, T-E-L-L-E-G-E-N, and what it does is it is two-port element. It inverts the current voltage characteristic of an electrical component or the network. In this case, the linear element, the impedance is also inverted. Back to you.
Yeah, with the right kind of a hookup of operational amplifiers, you can generate a gyrator function. And properly used, you can make negative impedance, you can make a negative capacitor, a negative inductor, a negative resistor. And there are times when those are very handy. And if you could get a pure gyrator all by itself, it would be a source of energy. But all of the gyrators that I've seen that are made out of operational amplifiers, you have to put power supplies into the operational amplifiers to get the gyrator function. So therefore, as a power generating device, there doesn't appear to be a method by which you get something for nothing. I can see how you would be very interested in gyrators because on the surface, they look like they could be an excess energy device.
Alan.
What was that?
Well, I have a few words about it. The ideal gyrator is similar to the ideal transformer. It is being a linear, lossless, passive, and it is lossless as it is being described as lossless, scientifically. Now, it is passive, it's memoryless, two-port device. However, where the transformer couples the voltage on port 1 to the voltage on port 2, and the current on the port 1 to the current on port 2, the gyrator cross-couples voltage to the current and current to voltage.
If you had an ideal gyrator, how would you like to use it?
I'm trying to find out, as we discussed earlier, the last time, how to minimize the impact of the EMF. That actually is one of the causes of me not being able to get to the higher what's the word? The higher performance.
Yeah, one of the things I said last week, and I still hold to it, is that there are people who think back EMF is undesirable. I'm not so sure it is. In the case of charging a solenoid coil that's got a magnetic rod in the center of it, the rate at which current and voltage are applied, the voltage applied to the solenoid and the rate at which current rises follows the, let me think now, the inductor-resistor time constant phenomenon because of back EMF. So back EMF really is a function of the rate of change of magnetic field, Faraday's law, and it represents the curve by which energy is stored magnetically in that solenoid coil with its magnetic core. And when you try to reverse the process, decrease the current, and you get a back EMF voltage, the energy you put in, for the most part, you get it all back out again. So once you understand an inductor, a resistor, and a battery, there's always going to be a back EMF, and I'm not so sure we want to eliminate it. It's part of the natural process of operation of charging an inductor, and the way and the method by which it gives you the stored energy in joules, magnetic energy stored in joules, is the mechanism by which you get those joules back out.
Yep. But we want this. We want energy without the losses. So whatever you store, you can recall. Back to you.
if I've got a high enough quality inductor where I've wound it out of wire that's got a low enough resistance, and if I've got a magnetic core that for the frequencies of operation has low enough hysteresis losses, for every joule of energy I put into that coil, I get very close to a joule of energy back out. If I use the right material, I can make an inductor as a magnetic field energy storage device that operates very close to 100% efficiency. Back to you, Wes, K2LIW.
So when you start to discuss ferrite magnetics and ferromagnetics, one of the applications of the ferrite magnetic is gyrator. Gyrators are circuits are extensively used in telephony devices to connect the POTS system, and this has allowed telephones to be much smaller, as the gyrator circuit carries the DC port of the line loop current, allowing the transformer carrying the AT voice signal to be much smaller due to the elimination of the DC current through it. That's one of them. But when I look at the different sources about the gyrator, all of them say it's lossless. Back to you.
Since the gyrators that I can lay my hands on are made out of operational amplifiers, and since operational amplifiers, unless you do something exotic inside by making them into a pulse width modulated amplifier, I start using a class D, E, F, G type modulation techniques. Until I start doing exotic things, an ordinary operational amplifier never even approaches 50% efficiency of power I apply versus signal I get back out. It's a kind of a class A amplifier. So the operational amplifiers I use to make a gyrator are lossy devices. There's probably a better way of doing it. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a comment?
Hey, Glenn.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the lossless gyrator, right, is a hypothetical or a theoretical type of device. In sort of like in the transformer, in the practical transformer, it's lossless. In, you know, in the ideal transformer, it's a lossless device. But in the practical transformer, there's resistance in the windings, right? Because the current has to be generated to create Lenz's law and have the voltage applied on the other side of the winding, and we've got the current coupling ratio in the transformer. But in the gyrator, we've got voltage-to-voltage coupling, which is, right now, like you said, everything practical that does that. Is there a true practical lossless gyrator? I don't know of any, Dick. Do you? I think that's what we're really coming down to. It's a hypothetical type of device, not really a practical device.
Let me respond to that. High voltage systems utilize to zinc flyback beyond the working voltage of the transistor amplifiers. That's one of the applications that I can see that.
Heard you only on the input, not coming through the machine, so maybe you haven't turned on your PL tone. Have you ever seen a gyrator, Wes, that's not made out of operational amplifiers? Over to you, Wes.
No, I did not. The subject is pretty new to me. I didn't come across these devices, but the invention is being known since 1948. And one of the applications that is listed, and you can read that, one of the sources would be actually Wikipedia also. The high voltage systems utilizing flyback, which says beyond working voltage of the transistor amplifier. Now, it also states that it is practically the equivalent of lossless transformer. The RF systems, RF inductors, are usually small anyhow, but the power conversion where the coil is used as the energy storage is being done by the practical application of this device. Back to you.
a transistorized ignition system or a transistorized high voltage generator. You could build that as a you could use transistors to trigger a Tesla coil. Because the transistors are operating in the primary circuit where the voltage is much, much smaller, you might not be, if you, with good design, you're not exceeding the maximum voltage those transistors can operate at, but you're using those transistors and the primary winding to store instantaneously, or for a period of time, magnetic energy. The inductive kickback, the flyback of that magnetic energy, is what gives you the huge voltage on the secondary winding, which gives you the high voltage output of your ignition system or your Tesla coil. So the transistor itself is supplying the primary to set the process in motion in a transistorized ignition system, but the magnetic storage and inductive kickback is what's really doing the work. And that system can be reasonably efficient. If the transistor is operating as a hard switch where it's either conducting or not conducting, and if the magnetic materials have low enough hysteresis loss, and if the windings have low enough resistance in the coils of turns, a transistorized ignition system, I'll bet you could run at 97% efficiency and give you the high voltage that you desire. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Very interesting. Okay, let's move further. We covered that part. Probably next time we can discuss the sixth element, which would be very much interesting. Now, when we're going to the subject why, I'd like to hear your response. Back to you.
It sounded like you said the subject why. W-H-Y. Don't know what that means.
Why? What I'm trying to do is go to the basics. Discuss what we need to know to measure the materials and what does it mean. And the question is, why do we need that? Subject number two. Basics of measuring the dielectric properties of material.
If you know the dielectric properties of the materials you use for making a microwave printed circuit board, it tells you the velocity of propagation. Once you know the dimensions of your microstrip or strip line or coplanar waveguide and the dielectric material properties, you know what impedance you're going to get, you know what velocity of propagation you're going to get, and by way of the measurement of the loss tangent, you know what dissipation of energy you're going to get into that PC board. So measuring the dielectric material's properties allows you to predict impedance, velocity, and efficiency, and maybe even radiation of the circuitry itself. So those measurements are the raw ingredients for doing a good design of that printed circuit board. Is that sort of what you're looking for, Wes? K2RIW.
If you go to that email, I pointed at first that I'm looking at this particular technique for the basics of different things. So, the basics of the measuring the electric properties of our materials will be resistivity, dielectric contact, constant, permittivity, permeability, electromagnetic wave propagation, dielectric mechanism, electronic and atomic polarization, orientation polarization, ionic conductivity, and interfacial or space charge polarization. Now, which one would you start from?
I would start from why is a network analyzer a valuable piece of instrumentation?
Beautiful. Okay, but this is easy. Although extremely exciting, how about if we're going to J, H2, if you go to two basics of measuring the dielectric properties of material, the J will be interfacial or space charge polarization, which stands for electronic and atomic orientation polarization that occurs where the changes are locally found in atoms, molecules, or structures of solids or liquids. Back to you.
This is not an area of my great strength, and I'm not quite sure what the question is, Wes.
That's one of the things that we have to know if you want to answer why, because then if you ask the question why, then we have to also know what. So, I'm trying to go through the particular subject that describes the material. So maybe we'll start with the first one, resistivity. A DC resistance measurement of the material. High resistivity is an important characteristic for insulating materials, while low resistivity is important for conducting materials. Any words about that?
KC2QIQ with a comment?
You got it, Glenn.
Wesley, I know that you mentioned measurements in a lot of these areas, and the answer to your why is that I wouldn't. What I would generally do in this particular case is, if I'm working with a material, many of the items that you're talking about, the resistivity, dielectric constant, much of the information on the material, I can either find in a physics book, a good engineering design book, or just if it's a specific compound, like a dielectric tape or something like that, I'll look up that material itself, and most of the information that you're looking for, I can look up on that material and find it on paper first. And then rather than try to measure it independently, where I could make errors and mistakes. So most of those items, Wesley, I think are best to be looked up by somebody, the experts who've already done it before, and the information is probably already available. Let me pass it back to Dick first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Beautiful answer. So, yes, I assume that we could go to just brief description of the terms. Then we go to the physical instrument. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, to a certain degree, I think Glenn is expressing a philosophy of the smarter kind of ham radio operators on, say, for instance, the microwave band. If I want to put myself 15 years ago on the 10 gigahertz ham band, which I did, what to do? What a smart ham does is to realize, all right, to make a transmitter, I need these particular components, a stable local oscillator, a microwave oscillator multiplier assembly, mixers, sources of signal, amplifiers, transmission lines, and so on. What a smart ham would do is buy the parts he could buy, build the parts he can't buy. Back in 1946, a really enthusiastic ham might start off with a pile of tubes and really build himself a receiver. Another ham, and that's a perfectly valid thing to do, but if you want to get the mostest for the leases, Hamelin and Hallett Crafters and some other companies made good receivers. You bought the receiver. The part that didn't exist is the transmitter for a particular frequency range, and you built that. You don't build everything if you don't have to. So when it comes to selecting materials you're going to be using, let me drop. Selecting materials you're going to use for building a circuit, if it's not too expensive and if it already commercially exists and that manufacturer sells it at $2 a pound and he gives you a data sheet as to what the material is and how it acts and what are its properties, you start off that way. Only if you have to use some kind of an exotic fluid, we'll say, somewhere in the machine, and you it's a weird mixture that no one's ever done before, and now you've got to measure the resistivity of that fluid or the dielectric constant of the fluid or its other properties, its loss tangent, and now you've got to make a measurement. And Damascus is a company, for instance, that sells you hardware that allows you to measure permittivity, dielectric constant, velocity factor. The Damascus company sells hardware that allows you to make those measurements, and it's because Damascus probably sells it at a pretty expensive price, you and I might give a good hard look at all of their pictures and go to your numerically controlled machine and decide to build your own version of it. So each one of us at each point has got to make some decisions. Do I buy or build? And most of the really smart hands that accomplish something do just the right mixture of buying and building. They don't build everything, they don't buy everything.
There is a catch.
A millionaire can go and buy everything. A really enthusiastic guy can try to build everything, but he might not live long enough. Go ahead, Wes.
The catch is, I recently have acquired a feature for an impedance gain phase analyzer, which allows me to go to 40 megahertz with the impedance measurement. And I was especially interested with calculating permittivity of the material. Some of the ferrites that I've got from Russia, I don't know what is the permeability of these ferrites. And there are existing features made for these devices, but they operate within the certain thickness of the material and the certain size of the material. Although, ham radio operators, and not only those, are very smart people. They make their own features based on the existing features. So, therefore, there is a device, looks like a diamond saw, that is used for sectioning. We know that ferrite is very difficult to cut, but not with these machines. You can simply section that ferrite and measure the properties of the ferrite that fits to the feature. That's the catch that I was talking about. Back to you.
I'm guessing that when you measure ferrite materials for their microwave properties, that those properties change considerably with the shape of the material, the thickness of the material, the length of the material, the frequency of operation, and depending on how you're exciting the material, what is the local E field and H field that you're putting through the material, all of that is going to make changes.
Operating with kilohertz, but the question to you is, what is the contribution of the size to this very low frequency in terms of permeability?
When I measure resistivity of a material, I'm measuring something that's ohms per square or ohm meters. I'm measuring it independent of size. I'd like to believe that when I measure true permeability of a material, and I'm using it at a frequency where there is not sufficient or not significant eddy current, I'd like to believe that permeability doesn't matter to size when it comes to the property of the material itself. What a resultant permeability I get, yes, that's going to be a matter of size and how big is my coil around it and whatever. But the true permeability of the material, I'd like to believe on magnetic materials is size independent, just like on resistivity materials, true resistivity is size independent. Over to you, Wesley, H-U-L-A-W.
Yeah, let's establish something. Permittivity and permeability. Permittivity describes the interaction of the material with the electric field, as permeability describes interaction of the material with the magnetic field. Now, in case of 4194, then the newer one was 4294, the newer one was 4394, and then starts with the E number of the Hewlett-Packard. Most of them does not allow you to get permeability, you get permittivity. Based on the permittivity, you calculate permeability. So, the question was then, in terms of permeability, do we have a contribution of the size in kilohertz? Wonder what Glenn says about it.
If you're still there, Glenn, do you feel as I do that resistivity, permeability, and permittivity, and loss tangent are properties of a material at a fixed frequency that are independent of the size of the material? You could talk about the properties you get if you have 1 cubic centimeter of the material. And from that, you should be able to predict what happens if you had 1 cubic meter of it. KC2QIQ, if you're still there, KQLX.
Items of, let's say, transformer core are all independent of geometry. But you can apply the material to a geometry and come up with what's called an A sub L. And what A sub L is, it's the inductance at 1,000 turns. So, and usually the equation looks like N squared times the A sub L, the inductance at 1,000 turns, and it's usually given in nanohenries. So usually when you're looking at a core, you'll see an A sub L, the permeability, and the A sub L is basically the permeability associated to the geometric size of that core. So it'll give you a basic idea of how much inductance you're going to get per turn. So from that, you can always back calculate them. So really, if you have a number of turns on a core or some material, and you measure the inductance without any DC in it, basically you can come up with an inductance number and then look at the cross-sectional area, the path length, and then basically from that geometry determine the permeability of the material. So really all you need there is an inductance measurement, know the number of turns, and the geometry of that material to find out the permeability.
I'm a bit confused with that.
Yeah, me too. If A sub L is inductance per 1,000 turns, that's inductance per 1,000 turns with a particular starting geometry of the material. Is that true, Glenn?
Yeah, exactly. So in other words, even for one type of material, for every different core size, there's going to be a different A sub L.
So therefore, if I choose a model number and brand name of a core, it has a fixed geometry, and now the A sub L tells me for every turn I put in there, it's an N squared phenomenon, I know how many microhenry I'm going to get for 1,000 turns, therefore I can square it by the turns N squared phenomena to figure out pretty close what inductance I'm going to get for some other number of turns of some other diameter wire as long as it fits into that core. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Before that, then, here's my confusion. A material has a certain dielectric mechanism or polarization effect that contributes to overall permittivity, and permittivity is one of the major factors to calculate permeability. A dielectric material has an arrangement of an electric charge that carries carriers that could be displaced by electric field. The charges become polarized to compensate for the electric field. Now, with this description, there is no word about the site. Enter here.
That's true, and that's a very difficult measurement to make. And to answer your question, Dick, is that yes, you are correct, and the equation is inductance L is equal to N squared times the A sub L, and A sub L is usually given times 10 to the minus 8 for nanohenries. Nobody measures the permittivity. It's just because the amount to find out permeability, there's so many areas of room for error, Wesley, that it's typically just not done. That's more of a science experiment than a practical measurement.
Well, you were talking about permeability or permittivity that nobody's measuring.
In the end, you want to come out with the permeability, correct?
Correct. But permittivity is built into my device.
Yes, it is, but in order to measure that, it's a science fair experiment, is what I'm trying to tell you. It's not going to be something easily measured, and you're going to basically come up with all kinds of errors trying to do it. With a simpler way to do it, and the way that it's just done in the industry, is you know the full dimension of your piece of material. Let's say you don't know what the permeability is. You don't know the A sub L. You know nothing about this piece of magnetic material. But you can measure it. You can actually, you know, take its dimensions and sketch it out on a piece of paper. You can put a group of turns on that material, take an inductance measurement. Now you know the inductance. There's only two, out of your mechanical dimensions now, the only thing you have to know is path length and cross-sectional area and your number of turns. So you have number of turns, cross-sectional area, path length, now you can solve for permeability.
To the point. describe only one method. The resistivity cell method is the one that you have described. There is another one, parallel plate, which is mostly capacitive method. There is a coaxial probe, which Dick would be very much familiar with. There is a transmission line method, resonance cavity, again probably Dick, and free space. All of these methods are for permeability, but all of them have disadvantages and advantages, Dick.
Let me ask you a silly sounding question at first, Glenn. In your mind, what is the difference between permittivity and dielectric constant? Over to you, Glenn.
I think one is arranged in voltage and its units, but I think that they're very, very similar, right, aren't they? I'm not exactly sure myself.
Just answer that. And to Jim. Permittivity describes interaction of the material with an electric field. The electric constant. The material is classified as dielectric if it has the ability to store energy when the external electric field is applied. If the DC voltage source is placed across the parallel plate capacitor, more charge is stored when the dielectric material is between the plates than if no material, let's say vacuum, is between the plates. Now, then if you compare to the permittivity, we're talking just about interaction of the material, not about the amount of interaction. Back to you.
My dielectric constant is usually quantitative. I might have a certain kind of plastic, and it has a relative dielectric constant of 3. That is, if I fill up the airspace or the vacuum space between two plates with this plastic material, I get 3 times as many microfarads as I had when I had just perfect vacuum in there. That's dielectric constant. If my material has a dielectric constant of 3, and I want to make a quantitative measurement of its permittivity, Glenn, what units of permittivity am I likely to get when I measure the permittivity of this plastic that has a relative dielectric constant of 3? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I mean, Dick, don't know.
Since the permittivity is relative to the free space, and it's in the direction of the material, but the electric constant is equivalent to the relative permittivity.
Okay, if I take the relative dielectric constant and convert it to absolute terms as opposed to relative terms, is the unit, the number I now get out of that process, is that permittivity?
Ben, I cannot answer.
Dielectric constant, not relative dielectric constant. That's my first guess. I just looked at it on Wikipedia, and my very quick reading leads me to believe that's what it is. And permittivity, do you think permittivity does or doesn't include loss tangent, Glenn?
Dick, at this point in time, it's not a unit that I work with most of the time. So, I'll look it up during the week. I'm pretty sure I do understand, but I don't want to really comment on something that I would give some bogus answer to.
Yeah, I think permeability, I mean, dielectric constant at a given frequency, I think it's got a real and an imaginary term. And the imaginary term, I think, is related to the loss tangent. But I've got to do some... I haven't done much work in this area. Over to you, Wes.
Pretty interesting, pretty confusing. If we go to point 3, measurement system, we have a high resistance meter. Usually Hewlett Packard has made plenty of them, a very high quality. The resistivity values are derived by the measuring of DC. Then another type with that group would be the LCR meters and impedance LCR meters. Now, the next one would be the network analyzers. A measurement of the reflection from and the transmission through the material. Now, may the